Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about mylifeinabook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, mylifeinabook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice to text feature, and mylifeinabook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Let's say you have a nightmare. Not a huge deal, right? These things happen after all. But what if it keeps on happening? Over and over again for a year. You close your eyes, hoping to get some rest, but instead you're assaulted with images of a man breaking into your home, abducting you, and then murdering you. I mean, there are probably a ton of rational explanations for something like this, and I'm sure that Cindy Anderson tried to tell herself every single one of them. But then, on August 4th, 1981, Cindy disappeared. Was her disappearance merely a horrible coincidence? Or did Cindy have a premonition about her own murder? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Cindy Anderson. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone. All right, before we dig into this week's extremely creepy episode, which is actually going to be a two-parter because there's a lot going on, I want to give a huge shout out to Christine H., who is our newest Patreon. If you'd like to support us, Ethan over here is actually talking about creating some bonus content of his own.
Uh-oh.
So that could be exciting.
Maybe, or it could just be a huge flop.
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, you know, there are no rules. It's fine. We'll just throw it to the wall, see what sticks. But I'm saying it, you know, in public so that you actually start working on it.
Oh boy. Now the pressure's on.
I know. You can go check us out at patreon.com/ATTWGpod if you're interested. But for now, let's get back to Cindy. Cynthia Jane Anderson was born in Lambertville, Michigan on February 4th, 1961 to Margaret and Michael Anderson. Cindy, her sister Christine, and their two brothers, Mark and James, were raised in a very strict Christian fundamentalist family, and church was basically their main activity. Though Cindy's parents had strict curfews and rules about who they could associate with, she still had a lot of friends. Like, she's very popular, very well-liked. And in 1981, the 20-year-old secretary even had a boyfriend. And the summer of 1981 actually seemed to be kind of a transitional time for Cindy. Though she was 20, and like I mentioned, she did have a boyfriend, she still lived with her parents in the same single-story home that she grew up in. And her boyfriend? Well, she knew him because he attended the same church as the Anderson family. But, you know, she did also have a full-time job as a secretary at the Neller and Rabbit Legal Center in Toledo, Ohio. And though that was in another state, Toledo was like only 10 minutes away from where she lived in Michigan, 10 miles away, I should say. But she wouldn't be making that commute for much longer because Cindy had just put in her 2 weeks' notice at the law office because she was planning on attending Bible college with her boyfriend, Jeff. And, you know, while this may not seem like an exciting and glamorous adventure.
Well, I'm sure it is for her.
Well, exactly. For someone who has never even moved, period,
yeah,
ever.
Right.
You know, it was a pretty big deal. And it really seemed like she was making just true steps toward adulthood. And it seems as though Cindy was really beginning to embrace that. She was reportedly spending more time on her hair and makeup, you know, just things like that. It really seems like she was a young woman who was just starting to find herself and figure out who she was and who she wanted to be. And, you know, though Bible college doesn't exactly sound like freedom, it was still something she was doing on her own. And it was about 70 miles from home.
Now, was this upsetting her parents?
No, I think they were all for it. So her boyfriend, Jeff, was already a student at that Bible college. And I think they approved of him. I think they approved of her doing this. Like, I think, you know, they saw this as a very acceptable and respectable next step in her life, you know? Mm-hmm. But her parents weren't in love with everything that was going on at this time. And it really does sound like Cindy maybe could have used a little more freedom. So just to give you an example of the type of home situation she was in, I want you to listen to a clip from the episode of Unsolved Mysteries on Cindy's disappearance that aired back in 1990. In it, her dad is talking about how she was more concerned about her appearance and skipping breakfast to spend more time on her makeup and things like that.
Just before she disappeared, however, she was becoming like a debutante. She was spending a lot of time on her face and herself, and she skipped breakfast for this reason. She spent more time on herself than she did on her stomach, and that may be part of the reason of part of the problem.
Is the dad attributing her wearing more makeup to being a cause of her being abducted?
A little, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not the greatest.
That's some solid victim blaming there.
I know. Yeah, so in everything I've read in which people like talk about this episode of Unsolved Mysteries, they always mention her dad. Mm. So, you know, clearly she was living in a pretty strict environment when, you know, when you're complaining about your 20-year-old daughter wearing makeup, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think that it was abusive or anything like that, but, you know, you can understand why maybe she was excited to go out and spread her wings a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
But while Cindy was embarking on an exciting time in her life, things weren't completely rosy. About a year prior to this, she had started having recurring nightmares. In them, a man she knew would come to her home, abduct her, and murder her. And now, I don't know if you've ever had recurring nightmares like this, but it absolutely can mess with your head. I mean, I had recurring dreams for years about helicopter crashes. And even though I haven't had one of these dreams in over a decade, like, you will still never see me voluntarily get into one of these things, which, you know, because every time we see a helicopter, I'm like, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Cindy was scared, you know, just in general. And it didn't help that in 1980 and 1981, Toledo was experiencing a lot of violence. In the months leading up to Cindy's disappearance, police were working on four different murders, and three of the victims worked in the same shopping center where Cindy worked. Mm. So between the dreams and like the actual murders nearby, you could understand why Cindy was perhaps overly cautious at work. Cindy generally worked alone at the office in the mornings while the lawyers were in court. She would usually just kind of hang out and answer phones, and then the lawyers would come in around noon or so, like after they were done with their court appearances for the day. So because she worked in what seemed to be a pretty dangerous place and she was by herself, she and her bosses took precautions. When Cindy arrived in the morning, she would always lock the door behind her. Knowing how fearful she was of someone coming into the office, her bosses even installed an emergency buzzer at her desk.
Oh, where did that buzzer go?
Okay, so that's the weird part. Because, like, when I read that, I was expecting, like, you know, in a movie when a bank gets robbed and yeah, then they press like the button and then it calls the police.
Yeah, panic button.
Exactly. This buzzer alerted the business next door. So I guess the employees at like the Pizza Hut or the Fashion Bug or whatever were supposed to come in and save her. I don't know.
All right.
Yeah.
I guess that's a shortcut to save some money.
I guess. And, you know, they are closer than the police. So.
Sure.
Yeah. So this is the scene we have set. A sheltered young woman working in a bad part of town with the doors locked, a buzzer at the ready, dealing with nightmares of being kidnapped and murdered. So we're already not in a great place. But in the weeks and months leading up to her disappearance, some other strange things started happening. First, some graffiti popped up in the shopping center right outside of her window. It said, "I love you, Cindy," from GW.
Mm.
Yeah, so Cindy was a little freaked out because, like, apparently there wasn't anybody else named Cindy who worked in that side of the shopping center.
Yeah.
So they figured it was about her. But, like, her boyfriend's initials were JL, and, you know, that really wasn't his style.
Defacing your boss's property doesn't really scream, "I love you."
Yeah, yeah. Especially, like, Mr., you know, Bible college.
Yeah.
But what was even weirder is that Cindy didn't even know anyone with the initials GW. She and her friends racked their brains trying to figure out if she had, like, a secret admirer or, you know, something like that. But no one could think of anybody in her life who had those initials. The graffiti stayed up for months and actually, like, appeared in other places, too. Like, there was some, like, GW loves CJ, and Cindy's middle name is Jane. Mm. And so she was, like, getting more and more freaked out. And then so finally, the original one, though, the one that was, like, right outside of her office, the owners of the building or, you know, whomever eventually painted over it. And then the graffiti artist just came right back and did it again, but this time bigger.
Mm. Do we know, did the attorneys file something with the police? Did the police ever really look into it? I mean,
no.
I can't imagine they had a whole lot of resources to spare.
No, yeah, I don't think that at this point it was ever a police matter. I think it was more of just like a building maintenance matter, you know? No, the lawyers didn't call the police, nothing like that.
Okay.
Because, you know, yes, it was creepy, but I don't know.
Yeah,
like,
it's defacing.
Yeah, it's still just graffiti, right?
It's not a huge
right?
deal, but I'm just curious if there was any CCTV.
1981?
I mean, maybe.
No, there was nothing. I mean, and even if there was, they definitely didn't even go that far. Like, this wasn't a huge thing that people were super concerned about at the time.
Yeah, I mean, retrospectively, when she went missing.
Yeah, well, they did, yes. After she went missing, yes, they did look into it a little bit more. But at this time, they did not. So there was that. But then right before her disappearance, things got a bit scarier. Cindy also started receiving mysterious phone calls. Larry Mullins was a client of the law office. He had stopped in to pay a bill, and he was just sitting and chatting, you know, with Cindy at her desk or whatever while he was paying it. And while he was there, she got a phone call. And being the secretary, you know, obviously she answered it. But immediately after answering, her face went white and she slammed the phone down. So Larry, of course, like, asked what the call was about, but she didn't answer him. A few moments later, the phone rang again. And Larry said that she seemed a little more apprehensive, but, you know, again, secretary, so she kind of has to answer the phone. So she does, and the same thing happens. So she still wouldn't tell Larry what was going on, but did say that she had been getting a lot of these calls lately. And, you know, Cindy told him she was fine, like, kind of put on a big fake customer service smile. Mm-hmm. But Larry said on Unsolved Mysteries that she looked absolutely terrified.
So did we ever find out what was said on the other line?
No, she never told anybody. The whole encounter bothered Larry so much that after he got home, he actually called the police. Mm. So he wanted them to send a patrol car just to drive around the shopping center to make sure that Cindy was okay. And he doesn't know if the police actually did go out there that day, but he clearly must have seen something on her face to make a move like that. I mean, I think that's huge, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, he's just a customer. He was going in to pay a legal bill, and, like, it bothered him so much that he went home and called the cops.
Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah. And this was on August 3rd, 1981.
Okay.
The next day, August 4th, started out as normal. Cindy skipped breakfast and left home at about 8:30 a.m. She got to the office around 20 minutes later and followed her normal routine. She locked the doors behind her, turned the radio on, and got the office ready for everyone who was coming in later. She answered a few calls, and in her downtime, she read her romance novel. Which, I mean, you know, like, I've had jobs like that before where, like, if your job really is just answering phones and stuff, like, it gets real boring. So I would read a lot. But yeah, so she had this romance novel that she was reading, and it even seems like she may have done her nails at one point. A maintenance man recalled walking by and seeing her at her desk around 9:45 that morning. And because remember, this is a shopping center. So you've got a, like, this office, it's just all plate glass windows, right? So everybody can see and everybody can see everything. So a maintenance man was just walking by doing his thing, saw her at around 9:45. But by 10 a.m., clients were starting to say that the phones weren't being answered. So we're looking at a really small window of time here, it seems.
Yeah, and in the morning, like daytime hours.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, typically, like I said, the lawyers didn't come into the office in the mornings.
Yeah, but I'm sure there are witnesses around. I mean, it's not like there's nothing else in this strip mall.
Yeah, but as far as I know, the maintenance man was the only one who physically saw her, though many other people spoke with her that morning, you know, who called into the law office. If this is to be believed, like I said, it was about 10 o'clock when the phones stopped getting answered. So it could really be a 15-minute period in which whatever happened, happened.
Yeah.
Two of Cindy's bosses, James Rabbit and Jay Feldstein, came into the office around noon after court. When they arrived, Cindy wasn't there, but everything else seemed normal. Like, the AC was on, they could smell nail polish remover, and Cindy's novel was lying down on her desk. Their messages from that morning were on their desks, and everything seemed fine. They assumed that Cindy was at lunch. The only weird thing was that usually when Cindy would leave the office, she would forward the phones and then, like, put a note on the door saying when she would be back.
Okay.
If she was leaving the office unattended.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, okay, she forgot to leave a note, like, whatever, you know, so her bosses really weren't super concerned, and they assumed she was at lunch, and then they're like, okay, well, we'll go to lunch. So they left, they went to lunch, whatever, came back, but Cindy still isn't there. So that's when they kind of started, like, looking around a little bit more, and they noticed that Cindy's car, a 1980 Chevy Citation, which I've never heard of that. Do you have any idea what that is?
Say that again?
A Chevy Citation.
No, I have no idea what that is.
All right, hold on. Let's Google this. I didn't Google this before because you know a lot more about cars than I do, and so I was like, well, Ethan will probably know.
Okay, so it's like a four-door sedan with a hatchback.
Oh, let me see.
Yeah.
Oh, it looks like my mom had a Dodge. God, some sort of Dodge that looked like that when we were kids.
Yeah, I don't.
But it was a two-door.
I don't remember ever seeing anything like this.
Yeah.
But.
All right, well, mystery solved.
They come in around noon, so. We're talking about a 2 hour window, 2 hour, 15 minutes.
Yeah, give or take.
Give or take. And they don't see any sign of struggle.
No, nothing.
So there's no mess in the office. It, for all intents and purposes, it appears as though she left on her own accord.
Yeah. And her purse and her keys were gone.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the only thing that was still making them worried was the fact that her car was out there.
Yeah.
Because when she would go out to lunch, she would usually drive.
So that to me says that. If she was abducted at work, it was somebody she knew.
Right. Or I mean,
she's not going to, like, get her purse and keys and lock the door behind her.
To be abducted by a stranger.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Or, but the other thing is maybe she was going to lunch and she did leave of her own accord, but then something happened after she left.
Yeah, but she said that the phones stopped being answered around 10 o'clock.
Yeah, no, you're right.
That's
too early for lunch. Yeah.
So something got her up and out. Something or someone got her up and out of the office
at 10.
At 10 in the morning.
Yeah.
Or thereabouts.
Yeah, so this next piece of information is one of those things that we run into occasionally with these cases. I truly believe it has nothing to do with anything, and it's a complete coincidence, but it's just creepy.
Like, there are a lot of things about this case that are just weirdly creepy. So when Cindy's bosses, Rabbit and Feldstein, were looking around the office, they picked up that novel Cindy was reading because it was just, you know, lying face down on her desk. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they did this, but they looked to where the page, you know, the book was open to. And the page it was open to was a scene in which the protagonist was being kidnapped at knife point.
Hmm.
And apparently it was the only violent scene in the entire book.
Okay.
So again, I don't think it really means anything. It's just weird.
Or perhaps she's reading a series of books, or maybe this scene is reoccurring in some of her books, which is leading itself to her nightmare.
Yeah, maybe. Basically, when her bosses get back from lunch and Cindy still isn't there, they're like, okay, this is not Cindy. You know, she's a model employee, like, yeah, very conscientious. She just didn't take off randomly in the middle of the day. So after she didn't return for a little bit, they called her house to see if, like, maybe she went home sick or something like that. Mm-hmm. Cause to them, that's like the only other logical explanation. You know, she felt really sick and so she didn't have time to write a note or, you know, whatever. But no one at her house had heard from her since she left for work that morning. So that's when they called the police.
So around about what time was that they called the police?
I'm not exactly sure. I think it was still sometime in the afternoon. You know, like before the end of the business day.
Yeah. So we're looking at a 4 to 5 hour window.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Before the police get notified.
Right.
Okay.
But Toledo police, when they were notified, seemed to take this case pretty seriously from the jump, even though Cindy was an adult. And as we know, she's perfectly free to just take off and not contact anyone.
Right. Yeah.
But I think the fact that she worked in a law office and her bosses were like, oh no, this is absolutely not correct, she did not run away, probably put like a little more weight on it.
Yeah.
Plus, as Toledo Police Sergeant Robert Cawthorn told the Detroit Free Press on August 8th, 4 days after Cindy was last seen, they were worried about all of the violence that had been happening in the area. He said, quote, "This case doesn't look too good. Two bodies were found Monday night in the trunk of a car 3 blocks from where she works. It makes us nervous because we've got a brutal killer running around that neighborhood," end quote.
Yeah, and perhaps the her boss has also mentioned the graffiti and the strange phone calls.
Yeah, I don't know when that all came into it, because they definitely did mention that at some point. I just don't know if it was on day one.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, yeah, they had this brutal killer apparently running around, but the sergeant was quick to point out that they had no idea if Cindy's disappearance was in any way linked to any of that.
Yeah.
But you can understand why they were maybe taking this a little more seriously than they would have if it was just an average missing adult case.
Well, yeah. I mean, this could be the start of a serial killer.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and they have no idea.
So the two bodies that were found in the trunk, mm-hmm, how were, do you know if they were linked somehow other than just working in that same shopping center?
Linked to Cindy somehow?
To each other.
Oh, to each other?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay. And you said that they were found in the shopping center, not necessarily that they worked in the shopping center.
No, that they weren't found in the shopping center. They worked in the shopping center.
Okay.
So, of course, when this investigation starts, the first step is to interview Cindy's friends and family. But they seem to quickly rule out her family and her boyfriend as suspects. And, you know, that's important because the boyfriend, you know, is always going to be your prime suspect.
Yeah.
But he was not for long. And again, he did attend that Bible college. So there is a chance they never went in specifically into like why he was ruled out.
He could have been alibied by school.
But yeah, he could have just been gone.
Yeah.
Then the next natural question is, did she run away? And that's an interesting one because, like I said, you know, there are a lot of like forum postings and message boards, things like that about this case. And there are a lot of people out there who really do think that she did just run away. You know, she came from this very strict, repressive
home life. Yeah, I was just
going to say that. And, you know, maybe she did just want something different for herself.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see how that theory could come about.
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody that was just about to get some freedom, it doesn't seem like that would be the time to just pick up and leave, you know?
Yeah. I mean, she's already put in her 2 weeks at her job. Like, why then? Yeah. I don't like that theory. And, you know, everyone said she was excited about attending Bible college and starting this new chapter, but that could all be bullshit. Like, who knows? But from a logistical standpoint, Cindy didn't have anything with her other than her purse and her car keys. Her brand new car was in the parking lot. Her clothes and her makeup were still at home. And the only withdrawal she had recently made from her bank account was $5 that she had taken out earlier in the week. So the idea that she just took off and started a new life just didn't really make sense to anyone involved.
Yeah.
And that's why it surprises me that I still see people like today, 40 years later, you know, tossing that out as a theory, because it's like, there's been no sign of her in 40 years. You know, I just don't think it's realistic that she just decided to run and basically pretend to be dead.
Yeah.
You know, when there's no evidence that she came from like an abusive family or she was in a dangerous situation or something that would warrant that extreme of a reaction.
Yeah. I mean, and we've examined some cases where the running theory was that they, you know, picked up and started a new life, like Hoagie.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't, I don't know. Again, like she's on the precipice of a new adventure in her life already. It just doesn't, that the timing just doesn't make any sense to me.
No, me neither. So police didn't put a lot of time into that theory. Instead, initially, they focused on the idea that Cindy may have a stalker.
Well, I mean, clearly she does.
Well, I don't know that it's
graffiti and the phone calls.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't know that that's like definitive. But I think it was absolutely a valid avenue for them to look down, right?
I mean, for sure.
Yeah, this creepy graffiti, the creepy calls, you know, the client had already called the police once about this. And remember, that graffiti was signed GW, so police tried to figure out who that could be. Cindy's friends had already determined that they had no idea, but police did soon find someone who did have those initials, the shopping center's maintenance man.
Have you ever wondered what it would be like to have a podcast host as your realtor? No, of course you haven't. That would be insane. Hey, it's Kona here to tell you that we can make that insanity happen because I actually am a realtor based in Northern Virginia. So if you happen to live in the area, I can help you directly, but I can also help anyone around the world achieve your real estate goals because I have an amazing referral network that I work with and I help people everywhere. I also offer special incentives to veterans, to active military members, to AARP members, and so many more people. So if you are interested in buying, selling, renting, whatever it may be, all you need to do is go to my website, callkona.com, and we can connect. And I promise I will also give you all of the tea and all of the background info on this podcast if you want to. So again, that's callkona.com. If you need real estate. So let's get back to the episode.
Oh, the very one that saw her at 9:45 in the morning.
Well, it's actually unclear if it's the same guy. I think it is, but I cannot say 100%.
It would seem strange to me that a shopping center has like more than one maintenance guy.
I don't know.
I don't work in a shopping center, so
I don't know. I, like I said, I cannot say 100%. I think it is the same guy, but either way, it certainly interested police. He was clearly in a position to be around Cindy's place of employment on a daily basis. You know, maybe he saw her through those plate glass windows maybe he even spoke with her, you know, kind of knew her. And maybe he became enamored and then obsessed to a point where he took Cindy to have her to himself. Especially if he knew that she was leaving her job, that's why he did it then, because he knew he had to do it sooner rather than later. So police, of course, interviewed the maintenance man, but determined that he truly was just a maintenance man who happened to have those initials.
I don't believe in coincidences. I mean,
there are a lot of them in this story, though. The book she was reading, the dreams she had.
I still think it's somebody that she was more familiar with than just the maintenance guy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, what is the maintenance guy going to say to get her out of the office willingly
at 10 a.m.
at 10 in the morning,
especially because she's such a responsible employee.
Right.
You know, I mean, maybe he's like, oh, it's a gas leak. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess maybe.
Yeah. But that was a dead end. And it was actually eventually proven that he wasn't the man who wrote the graffiti. Police eventually found that guy. He admitted to drawing that graffiti, but he said that he had never met Cindy Anderson. His girlfriend was named Cindy, and he had put it up for her.
Hmm.
And okay, this is, we're just going to take a minute and go off on a bit of a tangent, because it really brings up a larger point about how these old cases tend to go in the retellings over the years. And I run into this type of stuff a lot when I'm researching these cases. If you look up this case, you'll always read about this graffiti, but it's actually really hard to find sources that tell the whole story behind it. It sounds like police solved this part of the story, like actually pretty early on, but that didn't really get reported. And oftentimes both the maintenance man or some other GW are still looked at as suspects in this case. And I even saw a recent BuzzFeed video about Cindy Anderson. It was done like in 2019 or something like that. And they treated this graffiti as some big mystery still.
Well, it's sensationalizing. I mean, it that sells.
Well, yeah, but I think it's more of just like not digging deeply. And I know that I'm guilty of it too. I mean, I think we all are, but in this case, it just really brings that point home that sometimes these things just get repeated and repeated and they're not true. So I actually found the full story from the real Cindy, who is really upset that this whole aspect keeps on getting put in Cindy Anderson's story without the full context. And she was like so upset about this that she actually emailed Unsolved Mysteries in 2009 asking for a correction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And here's her email in full. And I do think it's important to like read this, even though we're going off on a tangent here, but I do think that this matters. Okay. Here's her full email. Quote, "It really bothers me that you still have the GW part of the story included. The part about the spray painting. My name is Cindy Betts. At the time, my name was Cindy Jones. GW was Greg Wixinski. He spray painted I Love You Cindy on everything from overpasses, garages, and the walls at the Manhattan Plaza where Cindy Anderson worked. They were for me, not her. I went into the Army from 1981 to 1985. When I was in Germany, Greg was killed in a motorcycle accident. You can verify this in the Toledo Blade newspaper. He died September 27th, 1983. He was only 20 years old. He was the love of my life. After returning from the Army, I seen the original Unsolved Mysteries. I was flabbergasted when I seen the spray painting part of the story. I contacted the show, and the next day, Detective Kulikowski came to my house. I gave him letters from Greg to me with the handwriting that was identical for proof. On the letters was the same I love you, Cindy, GW, and GW and CJ forever. He chastised me for not letting them know who GW was earlier. I was in the Army, knew nothing of this. I told him that the handwriting was also inside of the walls where a fashion bug was being built, and Cynthia Anderson could not possibly have seen it. If it were for her, why would it be anywhere she could not see? He acknowledged I was correct and said they did not put that information out there. Since it was in places she could not see, any good detective could have possibly opened their mind to the fact that maybe the messages were not for her and checked the neighborhood. All they had to do was cross the street, Manhattan Boulevard, and go down the first alley. This was Greg's alley, and there were plenty of GW Love Cindy spray painted on the garages. They were also on overpasses. He would get out of the car and run up the embankment and lean over and spray paint upside down. They could have asked any teenage kid in the neighborhood who GW was, and they would have told them. I'm irate because I feel this is left in the story for ratings, but the love of my life is being disrespected. I still have plenty of letters from him with the same handwriting and initials that were on the wall. This should also be in a file somewhere that Detective Kulikowski filed. GW was my GW, not some crazy abductor, and I am proud to be a Cindy. Toledo police dropped the ball on this with narrow-mindedness and not doing very good detective work. Since these messages were clearly on the inside of the unfinished Fashion Bug building where nobody could see it, they should have entertained the fact that maybe the messages were not for her and maybe found the real culprits. Instead, they tried to blame me for all the time spent looking for GWs. I was in the army defending my country, and we were in love teenagers who never knew who Cynthia Anderson was or even that there was a law office there. We hung out at the plaza because of the Pizza Hut, and when the workers left for the day, we went into the unfinished building to hang out. That's what teenagers do. This story needs to be updated with the fact that the spray painting had nothing to do with the story. I would be glad to send copies of my letters with postmarks to anywhere you want to send them for handwriting analysis. I believe good journalism should contain the truth, not just exciting possibilities to make the story more juicy. Thank you for your time. Proud to be GW's real Cindy. End quote. And I know that was long, but I just really wanted to read the entire email to set the record straight and get Cindy and Greg's story out there.
Yeah, it definitely clears GW as a possible suspect too. I mean,
yeah,
that's pretty definitive.
Yeah, and I will say that later down in that thread, because she does make mention to the writing being a place where Cindy couldn't have even seen it. And the writing she was talking about was in a place that Cindy couldn't see it, but there was like another graffiti in a place where Cindy could see it. So like that part of it was true. Cindy could actually see this, mm-hmm. you know, from her desk. And then the real Cindy does admit that, or, you know, stipulate that, I guess, you know, down the line of the thread. But the rest of it, you know, the point stands.
Yeah.
Like this had nothing to do with Cindy Anderson. Cindy was a very common name in yeah. the '80s, and it was like number 8 on girl baby names or something like that at the time. And so it's just this coincidence, but it keeps on getting brought up as part of the story. And, you know, I had to bring it up because if anybody had ever read about this story, they'd be like, hi, why did you leave like this huge part out? You
right.
know?
Yeah.
So I couldn't just leave it out because it has become so ingrained, but I really wanted to like tell the whole story. All right, but let's get back to Cindy Anderson. Cindy's disappearance is 100% not related to that graffiti. This we know. But unfortunately, days and weeks went by and no one found any clues as to where the 20-year-old could be. Her bank account was not getting used. She hadn't reached out to anyone. Nothing. But police are baffled as to what could have happened because there was no sign of a struggle and the door to the office was locked from the outside with a key. Cindy's purse and keys were missing, so it really does look like she voluntarily left and locked up behind her.
Yeah.
But Cindy's dad still thought her disappearance was related to the shady characters around the shopping center. He told the News Messenger on August 10th, about a week after her disappearance, quote, "There are a lot of spooky people around that shopping center. They drive by real slowly, and Cynthia just sits behind a glass window on the main floor," end quote.
I mean, do these creepy people that drive past wear makeup too?
Stop. It wouldn't be until a month after her disappearance that police would get their first solid lead. That September, the detective working on Cindy's case, Detective William Adams, received an anonymous call from a woman who said she knew where Cindy was. Detective Adams described the call to Unsolved Mysteries, saying, quote, "She said that she was scared and she was talking in low whispers. She kept saying she had to go. I kept begging her to stay on the line, give me more information, give me an exact address, something that we could act on. A short while later, she again called. The lady mentioned that there were two houses side by side owned by the same family and that the family was out of town. But their son was home and he was the party that was holding Cindy in the basement. We did check street after street on the north end to see if we could find two houses side by side. There's many, but you can't find any positive location to the house. End quote.
Hmm. So this is an anonymous phone call?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she apparently called twice and, you know, whispered, sounded panicked, and wouldn't say who she was or give any more specific information.
I mean, how would this person know that Cindy was being held?
I think the idea is that, you know, she knew the guy and maybe he told her or she saw something.
Hmm.
It's crazy, too, because in 1981, other than combing through tax records down at the courthouse, driving around looking for two white houses side by side was really the only way that they could approach this lead. And, you know, now as a realtor, like I have access to all sorts of databases that could help me get this information very quickly.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because if it's two houses owned by the same people, like that's something that I can search on. And, you know, we could find that. And I could determine if that's a thing in the town. But, you know, we're dealing, unfortunately, with 1981 technology. So ultimately, this led nowhere.
I mean, they could have done that, though. They could have gone down to the courthouse and tried to find...
I don't even know how you would have done that at that time. If you're just looking at paper tax records. Because... the tax records would be, they wouldn't be filed by the person's name. They would be filed by the parcel ID or the address. So you'd literally have to look through every single property record and see, just happen to see if two of them are owned by the same person.
Mm.
During this time, police, along with Cindy's boyfriend, Jeff, and some of her friends were also just searching around Toledo. Everyone on the search had come to terms with the fact that if they found something, it was going to be a body. They searched in the area around the shopping center, and the police went to places where other murder victims had been dumped. But there was no sign of Cindy and no real clues. There was even a $10,000 reward for information, which, again, 1981, like
yeah, that's a big money.
Ton of money.
Yeah.
But it turned up nothing. But a 1982 arrest would soon lead to two suspects. And those suspects are what we're going to be talking about next week.
Ah, come on.
In part two.
I know.
But we've got a lot to go through. I mean, this is a really interesting, crazy case. So, okay, before we get into... like actual named suspects. So right now, this is where we are. We know that GW is not it.
Right.
We've got an unnamed suspect who could potentially be holding Cindy in the basement of his family's house.
Okay.
And then we have more suspects, plural, coming up next week. So given that, like, what are your general thoughts in terms of where we are right now?
I'm still sticking with it's, I think it's a family member.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She left so willingly.
Yeah.
And then disappeared. I just feel like there's some sort of familial tie.
Interesting. So I get the comfort level, but I mean, other than that, is it like the extreme religious fundamentalism? Like, what else is making you think that it's specifically family as opposed to like a friend or something like that?
The extreme religious fundamentalism. Yeah, it's definitely playing a part there.
But why do it at work and not, you know, at home, I guess?
I don't know. And I'm not specifically saying it's her dad either.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. It's just a feeling I've got.
Huh. Yeah, that's interesting because... what I will say is that in everything that I've read, I mean, they really did just clear the boyfriend and the family very quickly.
How big is her family?
I don't know. You know, the Unsolved Mysteries episode is the most that they've ever talked about her family. Mm-hmm. Her sister was interviewed on the episode. You know, there are some subsequent newspaper articles that I read with her dad. But like, I've never read anything with her brothers or anything like that, or any extended family members. So I don't know. The only thing I do know is that, I mean, her brothers like eventually got married and had kids because, you know, I saw that in obituaries, you know, they were survived by like her brothers and kids and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. So I don't know how big her family is.
This is just a theory on my part. So
I mean, because we're covering this case, I mean, that does mean that, spoiler alert, like it's still unsolved. So that's interesting. But I will say the suspects we're going to talk about next week are not family members, but they really diverge. Like it's you've got different suspects who are totally completely like two way different theories of the crime, if that makes sense.
Are any of the suspects we're going to talk about close to her, friends of hers, without giving anything away, just yes or no?
I will say that one of them is not a stranger.
Okay.
Like I said, that will be next week. But if you are a Patreon member at the $20 and up You Belong With Me level or Gold Rush, you can actually hear part two in your feed right now. But for the rest of you, we will see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.